Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, when it launched in the UK more than 100 years ago, there were severe worries, particularly that it would kill the art of conversation, because from day one, radio had a profound effect on the lives of the people listening. A story BT Rubens tells in her book, Listen In, How Radio Changed the Home. BT, good afternoon.
Hello there. Thank you for having me on.
So when the BBC first launched, how many people even had a radio?
Well, this is the astonishing thing. To begin with, in 1922, about 150,000 people were able to listen to the radio, which probably means quite a lot fewer had radios because, of course, people gathered around. So only 150,000. And by 1939 and the outbreak of war in Britain, the number had gone up to 34 million. So it's a really astonishing take up, but a tiny number to begin with. Lots of them making, they're what are called radio hobbyists. They construct their own radio set, a crystal set. Some older people or people's parents and grandparents remember the cat's whiskers and so on. Mm. And a very few people have big expensive sets that cost loads of money.
But for that extraordinary growth in terms of radio ownership, they must have been made affordable.
Yes, they were increasingly made affordable. And of course, the greater the take-up was and the more sure that the BBC was that broadcasting was here to stay, because that wasn't a certainty to begin with, then the manufacturers began putting out sets at different prices. And, you know, people bought in at whatever price they could. And one thing that was, even very poor people, if they could buy just a simple or construct a very simple crystal set, once they'd paid the license fee, which was 10 shillings, radios were literally free to run. They didn't need electricity or anything. So they were very, very accessible if you could just make that initial outlay.
Yeah. And in the early days from, you know, the 1922 on, that first decade, say, was it even clear what radio was supposed to be, what they were supposed to put on it?
It's an absolutely brilliant question, that, because now, of course, we take it for granted that we can turn on the radio day or night, and there are different programs, different types of programs. There are the sort of punctuation marks of the news and so on. Once the BBC got going, I think the head of the BBC, they were pretty terrified because they had hours and hours to fill. And one of the things that really bothered them was that the newspapers were still very powerful, and government forbade any news on the radio before 6 o'clock in the evening. So to begin with, there was only on the BBC 5 hours a day, an hour in the morning, and then 4 hours towards evening time. But it was very random what went out. Really, they scrabbled around thinking, how are we going to fill these hours? It was really problematic. And for example, word went round the music halls, particularly in London, which was where the BBC began, saying they were, you know, desperate for live performers. It seems unimaginable now, doesn't it? But they had these hours to fill.
And so was there a leeriness about putting entertainment on it in the sense of the same kind of moral panic there was when television became widespread, that would rot everyone's brain?
Absolutely. Not only that it would rot everyone's brain, but as you were saying at the beginning, that it would be the end of conversation. And in fact, when I was researching my book, Listen In, and an exhibition at the Bodleian Library in Oxford with the same name, I found a most brilliant cartoon that dates to 1922, and it was published in Radio Times and Punch. It's a kind of two-part cartoon, and it's about the art of conversation. And pre-radio, there's people sitting around apparently having sparkling conversation. And then post-wireless, they're all sitting there with their own headphones, and it's sort of like the death of conversation. So there was quite a moral panic about what radio would do. And on air, there was quite a moral panic about what could be broadcast. And John Reith, the first Director General of the BBC, was very he had really utopian ideas about the way it would really educate people and spread, you know, make people who'd left school very early, give them many new opportunities. But at the same time, he was pretty po-faced himself. And apparently, you know, one early producer was rapped on the knuckles because one of the popular songs that was sung was Yo Ho Ho and a Bottle of Rum. And he said that encouraged alcoholism, you know, so there was moral panic both on and off air. Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, and when the, you know, we reach a situation where there are millions of radio sets across Britain, the sociological differences that's making, I imagine, must have been profound. And I imagine probably more those differences were for women than for men, because there would have been women working in the home listening to it all day long.
Quite right. So I've explored, you know, the impact on women and men, the impact on children and old people. And I think that during the day, radio really enhanced women's lives. The vast majority of women from all classes, after they married, were at home. And it was a very tough life, and I think a very, very lonely life. And suddenly they were getting music and talks and entertainment. But sadly, in the evening, which is when, to begin with, most of the broadcasting was, some of the research I've uncovered makes it clear that it was men who were in charge of the dial. And there are even some quite, you know, sad, ugly stories of men using radio almost as a form of sort of coercive control, saying, I'm in charge of the radio, and even turning up the volume. So that there's one story of a woman trying to get a bit more housekeeping money from her husband, and he turns up the dial so that she can't be heard. But that said, I think overall, for women, it was a hugely just enhanced their lives. And one of the things I write about in the book is the wonderful Brian Friel play that I know you'll know, Dancing at Lunasa, where you get five women all at home and their radio sets. It's set in 1936, the story, and their radio set sort of hugely enlarges, enhances their lives, although it also brings it home to them how isolated and poor they are. But that's the kind of impact I think is interesting.
Yeah, I suppose, because if you know, but prior to having a radio in your home, the world probably looked pretty two-dimensional. In it was just your immediate surroundings and your neighbours, and suddenly there was all these things going on all over
that's
the planet.
That's right. And although even quite poor people quite often had gramophone players by the 1920s, even quite poor households had them. But of course, people were just listening to the few records that they had. Whereas one of the amazing things about radio was, instead of, say, you were interested in sport, instead of just going to your, you know, going to see a match locally, you could follow sport nationally, or if there was a big national event or a feast day or whatever, it gave people a sense of being more united across the country. And I think that, again, some of the evidence I've uncovered makes people say, I found a lot of evidence from a working class area in Bristol, and people say again and again, it makes us feel more part of things, which I find really moving and interesting. That way that, I don't have to tell you this, you know, radio makes people feel part of a community, and that community also makes people feel part of the nation, if you like.
Yeah. And were the royal family cautious about radio at start? Because it seems as if they were quite keen to get involved, or at least the king was.
Yes, they were. Right at the beginning, when some of the earliest radio hobbyists were actually Boy Scouts, and there's quite a funny picture of the Prince of Wales, who later became Edward VIII. He was, you know, the king who abdicated, of course, of him dressed as a Boy Scout. And he's a grown man, but he's wearing short trousers and a kind of Boy Scout hat. And he's speaking on the radio to Boy Scouts. But they want to be involved, but they're a bit anxious about radio. And then in 1932, at long last, the king says, yes, all right, we'll do a royal Christmas message. And that's a moment, I think, where the that strong sense of broadcasting royalty and the nation really come together in quite a strong way. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you've worked in the Beeb for a few years yourself, Beattie. So do you think that's still there? Not just in the UK, but I suppose in the developed world in general, because now there are podcasts. Now there's, you know, always some randomer on Twitter who can tell you what's really going on.
Well, I think that, as you know, audio is absolutely, you know, having a long moment at the moment. Linear radio, I think there are fewer people listening, but all of the evidence is, in fact, I was talking to the controller of BBC Radio 4 about this quite recently, and he said again and again, if there's a big event, whether it's something like the Olympic Games or, you know, a royal death or a royal wedding, or let's say, mention no names, you know, the downfall of a kind of terrible disgraced politician, something like that, people return again and again to radio then. And also, as you know, I mean, during COVID, people feel somehow that the feeling that they can turn on the radio and that while they are listening right now, there is somebody speaking to them right now, that is not replaced in any way by, let's say, a podcast, which hasn't got that complicity, that shared quality.
Yeah, that immediacy.
The immediacy, that's exactly it. So I really do think, as the new chairman of the BBC said back in 1922, I do think broadcasting on radio is here to stay, even if the share now is a bit divided amongst other types of audio.
Beattie, thank you so much for speaking with us today. Beattie Rubens is the author of Listen In, How Radio Changed the Home.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.